It's March, and we're thinking about spring cleaning and freshening up. That's why we've got a new theme music here on The Eagle. It may be a new sound, but it's the same award-winning podcast that brings you inside the Times Union newsroom each week. We promise. I'm your host, Jessica Marshall. Let's jump right on into our first segment, which is one of my favorite recurring topics that we come back to at this very time of year. Movies. The 96th Annual Academy Awards are coming up this weekend, so that means it is time for our annual Oscar prediction segment with Times Union features writer CJ Lias. We sat down this week to fill out our Oscar ballots.
It's Oscars time. It's, for some people, the greatest time of the year. Maybe I used to think that way, but this year I am woefully underprepared. I did not see any of the movies, I think, except for the Barbie movie. I'm looking at the list of Best Picture nominees here. I only saw the Barbie movie, so usually I'm more well-versed. But here we are. It's time for your Oscar predictions. Let's tackle the top categories.
Well, let's just start with Best Picture.
Okay, let's hit the Best Picture.
You know, the year 2023 was the year of Barbenheimer, this cultural phenomenon that will probably never happen again in our lifetimes. But once it got down to the awards, it was pretty much all Oppenheimer.
This is a national emergency.
Detonator charge.
It's just been skating to the win.
Why do you think that is? Because I have a couple theories. Obviously, part of it is political, right? The movie, you know, the producers and such campaign. But I feel like the Academy and Hollywood just loves a good World War II history kind of.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
There's so many things. It ticks all the boxes. It's historical. It's a biopic. It's epic. It's from a very, very well-respected director who has not won yet, despite this reputation he has. I think it's all the things, and the performances are fantastic. And I think it's all coming together.
Yeah.
Just to be, and you know, Barbenheimer didn't hurt.
It got like an unexpected boost from the Barbie movie. I think, right?
Exactly. And to be a 3-hour long movie about the troubled genius who created or helped create the atomic bomb, and it still is the third biggest movie worldwide last year. Hmm. That's odd in and of itself.
Well, see, that was one of the things that turned me off about it, the fact that it was 3 hours long. I'm like, I do not have 3 hours to sit and watch a movie.
And I think that's where Christopher Nolan comes in, how talented he is. It's a thriller. It really is. Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of different filmmaking technique. It's not, you know, it's not your father's biopic from like, you know, the 40s or 50s or whatever.
My dad did like it. He was like, have you seen Oppenheimer yet? You should really see Oppenheimer. I'm like, I don't have 3 hours. But like, let's go back to Barbie for a second, because Barbie has a lot of buzz too for maybe various other, you know, categories here. But at one point it was considered, you know, a favorite for Best Picture. I mean, could there be a quote unquote upset? Could Barbie come through?
There's always some upsets at the Oscars. I think if it does, it'll be in one of the other categories.
Okay.
And I don't know why the narrative had to shift to one and not the other, mm-hmm. or any of the other movies this year. But Barbie was critically acclaimed just as much as Oppenheimer when it came out. It's the biggest movie of the year. But somehow when it got down to the end of the year and we're talking awards, especially with the Oscars, you know, notably Greta Gerwig did not get a director nomination, and the Academy loves her because she's gotten nominated before. Mm-hmm. And Margot Robbie, who's been nominated twice before for acting, did not get a nomination, which to me is the biggest, I don't want to say snub because I hate that buzzword, but Margot Robbie, she is the movie.
Right. She really is.
She created the movie. It was her idea. She put it all together. She's the producer. I mean, if it was to win Best Picture, she'd win an Oscar because she's one of the producers.
She thinks I'm a fascist. I don't control the railways or the flow of commerce.
That That's a great line. Okay, so that's a good segue. Let's talk about the actor and actress categories here. You said Margot Robbie is not among the best actresses, but who is, you know, who's your pick for, you know, best actress in a leading role?
It's funny because both lead actress and lead actor this year are the most competitive categories of all 23, I think, categories there are. And that you don't often find that. There's usually a clear favorite. So I have chosen as what I think – as who I think will win. In lead actress, I think it's going to be Emma Stone for Poor Things.
Okay. She's won an Oscar before, right?
Yes, she has, for La La Land. In both categories, it's between two people. In lead actress, it's between Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon. So it's Stone versus Gladstone.
Now, wait a minute. Just to interject here, Lily Gladstone is an actress of Native heritage, correct? So this would this be the first time?
Yes. She's the first Native American nominated in an acting category, so she'd be the first winner. I can't say I'm going out on a limb. Emma Stone's won many awards so far for Poor Things, but there are diehard people on the Lily Gladstone side and diehard on the Emma Stone side. So it's going to come down one or the other, and everyone who is on the winning side is going to say, told you.
Yeah. Well, Lily Gladstone has received accolades this year so far, right?
They both have. Kind of a split. The one thing with Lily Gladstone is that the initial – when the movie first came out and when people started talking about awards, they were debating, should she be in lead or should she be in supporting? Mm. There's an argument to be made either way, I think, based on her screen time. But, you know –
screen time, like the number of minutes you're on screen, is not that defining factor, right?
No, famously, Training Day, Denzel Washington has much less screen time than Ethan Hawke. He was nominated for lead. Ethan Hawke was nominated for supporting.
Okay.
So, you know, it's happened many times over the years.
And then, not to completely segue off topic, but wasn't there a movie, was it Network, where a woman, the actress, won Best Supporting Actress and she had like 5 seconds on screen or something?
5 minutes, but
five minutes.
One of my favorite movies of all time, but yes. Yeah, Beatrice Straight. She's known for having, I think it was 2 scenes she had.
Yeah, and she won an Oscar.
Yeah, they're great scenes, but.
Yeah. So the best actress in a leading role, you think Emma Stone is going to take it, but it could be between Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone.
Yes. The other three, as good as they are, don't have a chance, which is a shame because I would say Carey Mulligan in Maestro is phenomenal.
And anytime Annette Bening's name comes up in anything, I'm like.
Although, sorry, people, I actually don't think she should be nominated this year for this movie.
Okay.
That's just me. I think, in the minority there, but.
That movie is Naiad, right?
Naiad, yes.
Where she plays an older woman who goes for a swimming record.
Yes. And the physical regimen she had to go through to do this at her age also is amazing. And she does give a really good performance. I just didn't think it was one of the top five of the year.
Okay. That's fair. You know, we're all entitled to our opinions. And you've been right about many, many things before when it comes to the Oscars. So let's go to the actor in a leading role. Who do we got there? I see Bradley Cooper's name. I'm looking at my Oscar ballot. I see Paul Giamatti, like big names. Cillian Murphy. Is it going to go to him?
I think so.
Okay.
It's between Cillian Murphy and Paul Giamatti for the holdovers. Paul Giamatti's got the, you know, he's well-loved. He's never won before. The whole he's due thing, you know.
Well, Cillian Murphy hasn't either, right?
But this is his first time
nominated.
Which, you know, last year, all four winners were first-time nominees.
Mm.
That could happen again this year, except for the only first-timer in supporting actor is Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction. And as good as he is, he's not going to win. But I do think Cillian Murphy is going to win. He's going to ride that wave of Oppenheimer.
I think it's a big wave. I have not seen the movie. Again, we know this. I don't have 3 hours, but just based on what I have sort of seen come across my social feeds and all of that, like it just seems like, of course, I'm going to put him as the winner on my ballot. So, supporting actor and actress, who are your top picks for the supporting roles?
And these two are as close to set in stone already. Davine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. She's won everything so far.
Yep.
She is great. She's a Tony nominee. She's been in a lot of TV shows that everybody recognizes her from.
Ooh, she could be a future EGOT.
That's true. She, as I said, gives great speech. So Academy voters love that. When they see in the pre-Oscar awards what she does on stage, they're like, oh, we want to hear another one of those speeches.
Yeah.
So she's probably the closest to the other four should just go home as any. And in supporting actor, it's almost as close.
Okay.
I think Robert Downey Jr. will win it for Oppenheimer for one of the best performances of his career. Mm-hmm. The only person I think that could slide in there is Ryan Gosling.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that.
Which would be great. He'd be great also. And he's a two-time previous nominee.
But wouldn't that be weird?
Yes.
I feel like it would be weird if Ken, the role of Ken, he won for, whereas Barbie wasn't even nominated.
And that is when the nominations came out. That was part of what people were saying. But at least, you know, America Ferrera was nominated as supporting actress.
Okay.
So at least there was
somebody in there for the movie.
And Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach, they were nominated for screenplay. So, yeah, it would create a weird, weird little dynamic here. But he's great.
Yeah, he was pretty funny. I mean, I love my favorite line from that movie. Again, the only movie that I saw that was nominated was when he, you know, at the end, he's like, once I figured out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I kind of lost interest. Like, I love that line. It's hysterical. You know, America Ferrera, back to her. I mean, my impression of her performance, I thought she was Oscar worthy when I saw Barbie. Obviously, I didn't look at her in comparison to the other actresses, but, you know, some of her monologues in that movie are top notch. So I wouldn't be sad if she won.
No, actually, I think in that category, I wouldn't, because Emily Blunt is always amazing. Mm-hmm. Jodie Foster, as opposed to how I felt
Oscar
about
winner.
Annette Bening, Jodie Foster is so great in that movie.
Yeah.
And such a natural, lived-in performance and not like really actor-y, as sometimes big Oscar performances are.
Yeah.
But I still think it's Davine Joy Randolph all day long.
That is a respectable opinion. We will see. I bet you will be right. So we went through all of the, you know, the big, what do you call them, the big five. But then there's also the director category, which, you know, I think is pretty newsworthy this year. So what's your pick there?
Probably right after Davine Joy Randolph, this is the most certain.
Okay.
Christopher Nolan.
Okay.
Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer.
He's due, right? He's never won
before? Well, he's due. And, he's never made anything. Even when, what was Tenet, I think was the last one. Mm-hmm. Even that is not considered a flop or bad, or he's never made anything
It was
bad.
Definitely unique.
Yes.
I'm still wondering what the hell it was about, but it was very unique.
And, you know, I think going into a lot of his movies, maybe all of his movies, you don't need to know everything. If you go into Inception or Interstellar or Oppenheimer or even Memento, trying to parse out every little thing or trying to understand it all, you won't.
Yeah.
And I don't think he expects you to.
Okay.
Some of it, I think, is for the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So I go into his movies with that kind of feeling that, like, just ride it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think a lot of people are still sore about The Dark Knight, so.
Yes.
We'll see if, you know, he's vindicated with a win this year in the directing category. All right. Before we head off, I know there's a million other categories that deserve to be talked about. Are there any other categories where you think the outcome is going to be particularly remarkable?
The winner for makeup and hairstyling,
okay,
I believe is going to go to the team from Maestro, which might reignite the controversy of Bradley Cooper's prosthetic nose in portraying Leonard Bernstein.
A Jewish character.
A Jewish character, which many people felt was a stereotypically...
It was anti-Semitic in
nature.
Yeah.
That kind of faded a little once the movie came out. But I think a win from makeup would bring it back to the fore.
Sure. You got any others that you think are noteworthy?
Yeah, adapted screenplay. It seems like it's going to go to Cord Jefferson for American Fiction, which this is his first movie. He wrote and directed it, and it's his first time in both capacities, which happens a lot in the screenplay categories. That winner, I mean, look at Matt Damon and Ben Affleck for Good Will Hunting way back when.
How do you like them apples?
Which, side note, Air from Ben Affleck with Matt Damon should have gotten some nominations this year, but it did not get anything. But with Cord Jefferson, it's he did a lot of TV work and he adapted a 20-year-old novel. It's good. Wasn't my favorite screenplay of the year. And honestly, if you're going to give it to anybody, I would give it to Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach for Barbie, although I don't think they should be in that category. They should be an original screenplay.
I was thinking about that because, okay, like, you could play it both ways. It is an original screenplay because there's no Barbie book, but it's Barbie's a toy, right? Like, and it's a concept that was adapted. So, that is a weird gray area.
And the Oscars are one of the only bodies that did it that way. Everyone else put it in original screenplay.
Interesting.
They play by their own rules.
Well, there you go. Those are some pretty solid predictions. Thank you for sharing. Before we let you go, though, what are we going to see? What's the fun stuff that's going to happen in the ceremony this year?
I think this year the best song performances will be particularly interesting because two of them come from Barbie. They're the only two I think that are in contention, but really it probably will be Billie Eilish for What Was I Made For from Barbie. She wrote with her brother, Finneas O'Connell, which will be their second Oscar. But I'm Just Ken.
I'm just Ken. Anywhere else I'd be a 10. Is it my destiny to live and die a life of blood fragility? I'm
just Ken. Sung by Ryan Gosling, who the Academy has now announced he will be performing it.
Oh, fabulous.
On the show. And he wasn't sure about it. He was asked about it many times, but now they've said he is coming. I don't know if he'll wear the fur coat or not, or he'll do the whole dance ballet to it.
I think he needs to.
Yes. So he may not win Best Supporting Actor, and his song may not win Best Song, but he'll probably win the Oscar ceremony with his performance.
All right. Can't wait to see that. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will check back with you next year.
For a full rundown of CJ's picks for the Oscars, head on over to timesunion.com. We are going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we will talk about the Times Union's latest investigative project, an in-depth look at why serious police car crashes are spiking in New York State. Stay tuned.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union subscriber today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Marshall. The number of serious police crashes across New York State rose by 84% in the last decade. We consider a serious crash to be one that results in property damage, injury, or death. And for the better part of the last year, a team of Times Union journalists have been looking at why that's happening. I sat down with data and investigations reporter Emily Munson to talk more about what they found. You just completed yet another project for the Times Union, an investigative project. You spent a lot of time on this. And this one is about serious police car crashes spiking in New York State, you know, causing injuries and death. This is huge. So I want to kind of break it down in a way for our audience here. Can you give us kind of the 35,000 foot view of what you found in this investigative project?
Yeah, absolutely. We found that the number of police car crashes in New York that resulted in property damage, injury, or death increased 84% over the last decade. And we also found that 2023 had more fatal police collisions in New York than any year since 2012. And those were crashes involving a police car that caused death to an officer or a civilian. And even though these crashes are often really serious and they might involve, they do involve police who are public employees, it's really hard to get good data on these crashes. We found that state and federal data was really incomplete. And even some of the police departments who we were requesting records from couldn't tell us how often they were crashing, or their internal records on crashes missed some incidents. So it took us months of work to really uncover what was going on.
Wow. So what did you kind of find in terms of why these crashes, these really serious crashes, are ticking up in the last couple of years?
The short answer is it's hard to say. There has been very little academic research or studies into non-fatal police car crashes. Most of the research on this subject only concentrates on the police car crashes that cause deaths. And not many people in general have looked at this issue in depth. But the experts and the officers who we spoke with theorized that this increase in police collisions may be spurred by the growing amount of technology in police cars distracting officers. And also there's been a wave of retirements in police departments, and that's bringing in more young and inexperienced officers into the ranks of a lot of departments across the state.
Well, it's certainly a very complicated issue. Let's talk about the fatalities for a second. You know, the fatalities from these types of crashes are going up. I mean, who are the people who are dying? Is it the civilians? Is it the police officers? Is it both?
So 90% of the people who have died in police car crashes in New York over the last decade were civilians. They're just everyday people who are driving their cars, riding their bikes, pedestrians on sidewalks. We spoke to one mother named Claudia Stinson. She's from Long Island, and her son Anthony was struck by an officer while he was riding his bike home from playing football. He was only 13 years old when he died. We also spoke with families of officers who have died. In several of the crashes in which New York officers have been killed, it was a police car that veered off the road and crashed. Across the country, about half of all officers who die in on-duty crashes are not wearing a seatbelt. So that's a major trend that many police departments are trying to reverse.
Now, of course, New York State law says police officers don't have to wear their seatbelts, right, in all circumstances?
That's correct. Yeah, police are exempted from several of the state traffic laws, and that's one of them. In many cases, police departments by policy will require officers to wear a seatbelt. But this is something where the culture around seatbelt wearing is changing for officers. There has been this trend where officers do not wear a seatbelt because they may worry that it will impede their ability to get out of the car fast enough. If they're being ambushed, if they need to rush out of their car to assist when they arrive at a call, some officers find that their seatbelt interferes with their gun holster or their radio, and so it can be sort of a pain to clip and unclip it. However, of course, a seatbelt is important for safety when you're driving.
So, all right, we've talked about all of these crashes. You know, you talked briefly about why they might be on the rise, but let's drill down a little bit. I mean, who's at fault for these crashes? Is it the police officer that's held at fault? Is it the civilian that's held at fault? Like, what are the trends there?
There are definitely situations of both. Sometimes police cause car crashes, and sometimes civilians cause car crashes involving a police vehicle. With civilians, we see that sometimes they fail to yield to emergency vehicles. They might sideswipe a police car, rear-end them, all the kinds of situations that you might see on the roads in general. But we also found that police could have avoided numerous crashes according to their own records. So the Syracuse Police Department recorded in their records that they were liable for 51% of their crashes from 2016 to 2021. The Yonkers Police Department found that 55% of their crashes in 2023 were avoidable by the officer. And state police found that 25% of their crashes over the last decade were avoidable by the officer. That's like 2,000 crashes, by the way. State police has huge numbers of crashes. And some of the top situations that these crashes are happening under are officers backing up into things, distracted driving, and officers driving at excessive speeds. Those can all be causes of avoidable police crashes. We also see a number of situations where police hit deer in a roadway. That was a really common scenario for the state police, especially because they drive in very rural areas.
You know, what's the next step? What can be done about this?
I interviewed a research epidemiologist who works for the federal government, and she's studied police car crashes for 17 years. She told me that the most important steps to reducing crashes are training and culture for police. Let's start with the training piece of this. Police in New York are required, when they're at the police academy, learning how to become an officer, to complete 21 hours of emergency vehicle driving training. However, once a police officer leaves the academy and they've finished that initial training to become an officer, when they're working during their careers, most police departments do not give officers any continuing training on driving techniques. So they may never get to practice these skills again in a training setting. And we found that this is different than other states. We found that some other states require more training than New York officers get. Texas and Michigan mandate 32 hours. North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and California want 40 hours. And California also makes officers do 4 hours of driver training every 2 years during their career.
Are there any sort of exemplary police departments that you found?
Yeah, we examined a police department in Las Vegas and one in Virginia that have both received national attention for their work on preventing crashes. I'll start with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. They were motivated to work on this issue because in 2009, there were 3 Las Vegas PD officers who died in car crashes, and they had 84 officers injured in crashes that year. Their leaders wanted to do something about this issue. They launched a program to reduce collisions that included several new policies, a lot of training for their officers, and an awareness campaign about safe driving. They capped the speeds that officers were allowed to drive at, and they mandated regular driving practice. And then they brought in this team of scientists to study what happened. And those researchers found that, in fact, when they implemented these changes, their crashes decreased, their injuries from collisions dropped significantly, and the agency actually saved an estimated $1.1 million in just 2 years after they started this work.
Wow, that's a remarkable result.
Yeah. Another police department we looked at was in Chesterfield County, Virginia. That department has been able to cut the number of crashes that police were at fault for by half at their department. And they've done that by adding more training for their officers, just like Las Vegas did. They also set rules around how fast officers can drive in situations where they're going to calls that are non-life-threatening. And they really hold officers accountable by auditing their speeds, making officers justify how fast they're going. And they have regular reminders about safe driving. Like each year they have a lecture by a widow of an officer who was killed in a crash to remind officers about the serious consequences that can come from collisions.
Wow, those are impressive results from both of those police departments. All right, let's go back to something that you mentioned earlier in this conversation about the increase in technology that, you know, your average law enforcement officer would have in a car, right, that could be contributing to this uptick in crashes.
Okay, so this is our onboard computer. We can write tickets, do accident reports. We can check people's licenses or plates. This is our radar unit where we would obviously check people's speed.
You actually got a chance to ride in a police car, a local police car recently for this project. I mean, tell me about that experience. What did you see inside the car?
So what I remarked on is there are a lot of technologies in a police car that you are not going to find in a car that you and I might drive. So when you're sitting at the wheel of a police car, you are basically surrounded by scanners and screens. There is a computer, a laptop computer that is mounted into the car. You have your radar scanner on the dashboard. There's a camera up there recording video. You have controls to manipulate your lights and sirens. There's a printer, a scanner for scanning licenses, all sorts of technology.
It's like a mobile office, it sounds like.
It is a mobile office. And many officers spend 8 hours a day in their car, and they do almost all of their work in their car. So all of these features of the police car can be distracting to the officer when they're driving, to say nothing of the cell phone that the officer also has in their car. One thing that we learned that I just find to be fascinating, we were told by the program manager for the National Law Enforcement Roadway Safety Program that the cockpits of airplanes are intensely regulated and go through significant research and design studies before a pilot is ever put in the cockpit in order to make sure that that cockpit is optimally designed to make sure that it has all of the functionality that a pilot might need to fly the plane, but also doesn't have too many distractions that would hurt their ability to fly the plane safely. Basically, there is no such research done on police cars. There is literally no research that is being done into all of these technologies that are going into police cars and where they are placed and how they're affecting the officer's ability to drive.
Head over to timesunion.com for more on police crash data analysis and videos. And as always, you can read more about all of the stories and issues that we discuss on this podcast there or on any of our social channels, Facebook, Threads, Instagram, and YouTube. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more from inside the newsroom. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by myself, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks to CJ Lias and Emily Munson for their contributions to this episode.